7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist.
Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Aura Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Between October 7th and the end of 2023, Israel's war in Gaza cost it an extra $8 billion. That war looks set to continue, and the funding for it is going to have to come from somewhere. The somewhere looks like the welfare state.
And our culture editor takes us to Maastricht to visit one of the last art fairs to focus on old masters by long-dead Europeans. The limited supply of these valuable works is still enticing museum collectors from across the world. But first,
lots of people love TikTok, but Americans really love TikTok. Something like half the population is on there for nearly an hour a day.
On this vote, the yeas are 352, the nays are 65.
That's why a vote in Congress yesterday stands to change the country's media diet so much.
The bill is passed, and without the objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The House of Representatives passed a bill barring app stores and internet providers from distributing foreign adversary-controlled applications. Their target was clear. TikTok's boss, Shou Chu, wasn't happy.
Hi everyone, it's Shou here. Just wanted to share some thoughts with our US users about the disappointing vote in the House of Representatives.
He announced, on TikTok where else, that the battle wasn't over.
We will continue to do all we can, including exercising our legal rights, to protect this amazing platform that we have built with you.
This bill becoming law would be seismic. The platform isn't just entertainment, it's news, it's businesses, and individual livelihoods. Increasingly, it's politics too. Joe Biden's campaign recently joined the platform.
Young people should not have to go deeply in debt.
Bernie Sanders, a stalwart socialist senator from Vermont, has 1.4 million followers on there.
That is totally absurd. We want the best educated workforce in the world.
So it's worth knowing what it is that these lawmakers are trying to accomplish and whether this bill would do the trick.
Yesterday, the House of Representatives voted for a bill which, in effect, would force ByteDance to sell TikTok to a non-Chinese owner.
Tom Wainwright is The Economist's tech and media editor.
This controversy's been bubbling away for a while, and it seems as if tensions between America and China have reached a point where this legislation could no longer be stopped.
So what does the passage of that bill mean? What's next?
Well, it's not necessarily all over for TikTok just yet. First of all, obviously, the bill has to get through the Senate, and it's not entirely clear that that will happen. Even if it does, it will then have to contend with a lot of legal challenges. We can certainly expect ByteDance to challenge this in the court as far as it possibly can. And after that, there's the question of who the president will be by the time all this is done. Joe Biden has said that he supports this initiative.
Do you still support banning TikTok? Would you sign that bill?
If they pass it, I'll sign it.
But Donald Trump, who in the past wanted to ban TikTok, has said that he now wants to keep it. So if he wins the election, then the whole thing may be frozen indefinitely as well.
But let's wind back a bit here. What is the bill trying to address? What is it that TikTok is doing wrong by these legislators' reckoning?
I think there are a couple of main concerns, really. One is about data privacy, the fear being that TikTok is hoovering up all the data of its users in America and elsewhere and funneling it back to China, where Chinese spies can find out what kind of videos you like and possibly much more, including your location and other data that the app takes from your phone. And then there's another worry, which is a totally different concern, which is that TikTok could be used as a kind of propaganda tool by the Chinese government. In other words, if somebody in Beijing were able to get their hands on the algorithm and tweak it, they could affect what viewers around the world see. It could mean that they see more pro-Trump stuff or more pro-Biden stuff or more pro-Hamas stuff or whatever it might be. The worry is that TikTok is in effect now an important news medium. And so having it arguably under the influence of a hostile foreign government is something that the American government is concerned about.
And what's your take on those fears, either on data harvesting or propaganda distribution?
I think the first fear is somewhat overblown and the second one is a real one. On the data stuff, first of all, there's no evidence that TikTok is taking any data off people's phone other than what it has declared it's taking. So in other words, that there's no sign that it's a kind of a spy app as far as anybody's been able to establish. It does take lots of data off your phone, but no more than most of its rivals like Facebook. And if the Chinese government really wants to spy on Americans or anybody else, most of that data is stuff that it could buy on the open market from third parties. So I can understand those concerns, but I think that those in themselves are probably not sufficient to want to ban this app altogether. The other fear, though, I think is a bit more well-founded. This is the propaganda or the influence fear. If you compare TikTok with other media organizations, old media companies, whether that's newspapers or TV stations, face fairly strict restrictions if they are to be acquired by foreign companies or foreign governments. And new media organizations really, I think, ought to face the same tests and the same kind of scrutiny. TikTok, as I mentioned, is increasingly used as a news service by people, especially by young people. And to have a news service in the hands of a foreign country, which America classifies as an adversary, raises obvious questions. China wouldn't be allowed to buy CNN and it wouldn't be allowed to buy Channel 4. And it seems to me that new media companies ought to go through equivalent scrutiny.
Now, along the way there, you referred to TikTok as a news service, but it's not really, though. It's a big, messy collection of videos that happens to include some stuff you could call news.
Well, that's right. It includes plenty of stuff, but in the past, at least, it has shown that it's been willing to moderate that content in a way that certainly by Western standards would be seen as illiberal. There was a time when references to the Tiananmen Square massacre, for example, were censored. And TikTok says that that's all changed and it's gone through some pretty extensive efforts to persuade American politicians that users' data is safe and that the algorithm is not being tampered with in Beijing. It's opened up its code for inspection. But it's undermined itself a bit too. One of its arguments against this forced divestiture, which the bill passed by the House yesterday would enforce, is that it claims that separating its American business from the rest of the company is impractical because the two are so closely linked. And this kind of undermines its argument that it's simultaneously trying to make, which is that its American business is strictly separated from everything that goes on in China. So I think that hasn't done it any favors. And at the same time, this week, it made a huge lobbying error when it pinged a lot of its users in America, urging them to contact their congressmen. And I think for many wavering congressmen, this just underlined the idea that TikTok has this sinister political power. So for a while, it seemed to be keeping these efforts to ban it at bay. But I think it's been making missteps recently. And I think that's one reason why we've seen the vote that we saw yesterday.
I guess the question is whether that forced divestiture, the selling of the American part of the business, actually solved the questions that are at hand, that take care of any issues you might worry about from what you'd call a hostile government.
I think if it were sold to either an American company or a company that's at least based in a country that America doesn't classify as an adversary, I think it would help to allay most of these concerns. TikTok is not a strictly Chinese company that's based in China. They're always at great pains to point out that their headquarters is not in China. Their CEO is a Singaporean, but links do remain. It's owned by ByteDance, which is an essentially Chinese company. And I think if that ownership were to change and TikTok were to be owned by a company based elsewhere, or if it were to be publicly listed on the markets outside China, I think that probably would satisfy most reasonable concerns. The question really is whether China would allow that to happen. It sees TikTok, understandably, as a kind of jewel in the crown of its international digital apps, and many people doubt that it will allow TikTok to be sold to an American company.
And so as far as its user base and the tech landscape more broadly, what do you think the best possible outcome at this stage is, notwithstanding the votes that are still to come?
Well, I think the best outcome is one in which TikTok stays around, stays on the scene, but manages to lose its ties to China. It's been a good thing for competition in social media. You know, remember a few years ago, we were having discussions about how this was a over-concentrated market and how Meta and a handful of other American companies really dominated this scene. And the arrival of TikTok has completely blown that up. It was, by one measure, the most downloaded app last year worldwide. And it's forced innovation and competition into this market, which previously was considered to be almost closed to upstarts and new competitors. Banning it would be a real shame. I think the best thing would be if it can stick around, but without those Chinese ties. So that could mean ownership by an American company or an American consortium or another non-Chinese consortium. It could mean a public listing. But I think those Chinese ties do have to go, given that this is now effectively a pretty large news organization.
Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
Five months into Israel's war with Hamas, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has secured the approval of the Knesset for his emergency wartime budget. The fighting has come at a steep cost in lives and shekels. Israel is making some dramatic changes to stay on a sound financial footing. The budget would double military spending and slash funding for the Ministry of Welfare and Social Affairs. Simply put, more guns, less butter.
For 70 years, Israel has provided its citizens with a welfare state, and it's ensured relative safety with a robust military.
Kerrion Richmond-Jones is an economics correspondent at The Economist.
These are the two tenets of its social contract, but the economic consequences of war are upending both.
How strong is Israel's current economy? Give me a sense of numbers here.
Israel's economy has been one of the biggest success stories in the post-World War II global economy. And even before October 7th, it was having a bit of a bad year, but it was still really strong. So debt to GDP was 60%, well below the OECD average. That's a benchmark that we use for rich countries. Growth was on track for over 3%. Then that all changed. Between October and December, the economy shrank by about a fifth. That was much, much more than the central bank was expecting the impact of war to have on the economy. A sixth of the Israeli workforce was either called up to fight or was displaced by the war. And in the final quarter of last year, the armed forces burned through about 30 billion shekels. That's the equivalent to $8 billion or 2% of GDP. So last month, Moody's, a credit rating agency that issues outlooks on how sustainable it thinks countries' debts are, downgraded Israel's rating for the first time. It's still very good and very solid, so it went from an A1 to an A2. But the outlook, according to Moody's, is negative, meaning that future downgrades could be on the horizon.
So which sectors of the economy are looking particularly weak?
Anything that relies on Palestinian labour basically is a bad bet. Israel has prohibited West Bankers from entering Israel to work since October 7th. That hits construction particularly hard. You see idle sites throughout Jerusalem. More than half of construction sites, according to the Israeli government, still aren't functioning. Agriculture has been very badly hit. Farms have lost more than half their workforce. Tourism is another area. In January this year, there were 77% fewer visitors than this time last year. And to bring them back, the government would need to convince would-be tourists that the country is safe enough for holidays.
Now, what about the country's tech sector, which is often spoken about?
This really surprised me when I went to Israel. It's managed to do much better than I was expecting, or I think really anyone in the economy was expecting. It's very globalized, which means that although a lot of its workers are reservists, companies have been able to reallocate labor abroad. So they send work to their offices in Europe or in America. So that takes a bit of the weight off the Israeli offices. Some firms are even predicting profits because they could win new government contracts. Eventually, after the dust has settled on this, we will see a total overhaul of the IDF and its suppliers. I spoke to a lot of tech executives who use very nationalistic and patriotic language and that they use to motivate their workers. And a lot of them said that the productivity per worker in the weeks after the war had actually gone up. But the industry has slowed down some. It's just that it's at a rate similar to other tech industries, and it's nowhere near the kind of damage that the government would need to be seriously worried about.
So now, in that tougher economic context, what is Mr. Netanyahu proposing in his budget?
So the thing that Netanyahu wants to get done is double military spending. To do that, he's doing a few things. So he's increasing taxes, but very, very, very modestly. There's going to be a 1 percentage point increase in VAT, value-added tax, and a very tiny hike in health income tax. That's a tax that all Israelis pay on their income, and it's meant to go to funding the health service. That's going to be nowhere near enough to cover this extra spending. The worry is that if you have any more tax hikes, people won't be able to afford them. Tech firms are going to think about relocating. So he has to cut elsewhere. The next big thing that Netanyahu spends on is coalition funds. And these are things that keep his right-wing coalition together. So cash for settlers in the West Bank. Another coalition spending source is religious schools. A lot of people think that this should go in order to finance the military spending. But Mr. Netanyahu has proved completely unwilling to budge on it. That's what's so shocking about this budget. So what Mr. Netanyahu is actually cutting is Israel's welfare state. He's proposing an 8% cut to the ministry that's caring for people forced to locate for the war and for the returned hostages. And also a 15% cut to the ministry that cares for Arab Israelis, for Arab Israeli communities, and gives their local governments cash.
How politically popular are all these cuts?
They're incredibly unpopular. Netanyahu in many ways is in a hard place, right? Because another thing that Israelis feel is completely unsafe after October 7th. Israel has one of the biggest militaries in terms of GDP per capita and the amount of military spending in the entire world. And yet it totally failed to keep its population safe on October 7th. So Israelis very much feel like there needs to be an overhaul. There needs to be an increase in military spending. That spending will go on things like increasing the length of time for reservists, some of which will now have to spend 3 years in the army and then get paid. It will also go on a brand new generation of military equipment. And that's popular. But at the same time, these welfare cuts are increasingly unpopular, and it builds on a mounting discontent with this government and not only how it's handled the war, but its social policy. There's a sense that Israeli civil society is really strong, and that's great, but it's been picking up a lot of the government's slack since October 7th. There are 135,000 evacuees from the north and the south of Israel near the Lebanese border and the Gaza border that are still out of their homes. And the government's done very, very little to help them. It's kind of paid their bills once a month, but they've had no stability and almost no handouts. And instead, civil society, charities, NGOs have been doing all the work. And there's a sense that the Israeli state and its welfare state have never been weaker, but Israelis have never needed it more.
So what's the bottom line? Can Israel actually afford to continue this war?
Israel can afford to continue the war. The question is, what cost is it willing to pay? The public knows that the security of Israel relies on a stable economy. It cannot risk a financial crisis, as happened in the Yom Kippur War, the last time that Israel kind of went to war in this scale. At that point, inflation reached almost 500% as the government tried to pay off the bill because it had just spent far too much. Today, inflation remains low and the central bank appears determined to keep it so. As long as Benjamin Netanyahu remains in power and keeps on spending all this cash in an ultra-Orthodox population, it looks like one side of Israel's social contract is going to have to give, the welfare state or security.
Karian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you ever so much for having me.
I recently traveled to the small Dutch city of Maastricht. To many, it's best known as the birthplace of the European Union. But every March, It's the place where art aficionados descend.
Alexandra Switch-Bass is The Economist's culture editor.
I was able to walk around the 270 booths and look at museum-quality works. I looked at beautifully framed work that was probably given by the King of Naples to a pope in the 1700s. Hundreds of portraits that are hundreds of years old, lovely sculptures. And so it's like going to a museum, except everything is for sale.
Alexandra, what was up for grabs?
Every March, the European Fine Art Foundation, known as TFAF, puts on a fair, and about 50,000 people come to look at the artwork, and many art collectors buy. But what's pretty exceptional about the fair is the density of museum directors and curators. Of the 50,000, 650 of them this year were curators. About 300 were museum directors. So it's kind of like walking around a cocktail party in Los Angeles where you spot famous actors. This is the equivalent for the museum world. And the works are of exceptional quality. There's a lot of art fairs around the world, but Maastricht is unique in several ways. The first is it's the last remaining art fair focused on European old masters. So these are paintings done roughly from the 1200s to the early to mid 1800s. And the other thing that's pretty unique about Maastricht is the vetting process. After the fair is set up, the dealers have to leave to allow specialists to come in. Over 200 specialists come in to vet the artwork and make sure that everything is authentic, the provenance or who owned it is as it is stated to be on the placards next to artworks. And sometimes things are removed. I spoke with Will Corner from TFAF, who told me tens of objects get removed each year for not being authentic.
Any object that fails this vetting test is removed from the stand actually while the exhibitors aren't there, and they are able to appeal that process if necessary because they might have other information that the vetting committee might not have been privy to when they made their decision. And that process can be a sensitive one, but it's something that is essential to the fair.
And what happens to the objects?
They're taken away to a storage on the premises of the Met, and the dealer doesn't get it back until the end of the fair.
What insight does Maastricht offer into the art world?
Maastricht is more than a destination for breathtaking art. It is a really interesting opportunity to assess trends in collecting. And you can see that both from the private client side and also the museum side. When it comes to private collectors, you don't see old masters in favor as much as they used to. Back in 2003, old masters accounted for about 16% of sales by value at auction houses. Last year, it had fallen to about 4%. There's a few reasons for this. The taste of buyers has changed. Social media kind of conditions people to like bright canvases and large canvases. Old masters, you have to really be careful about condition because these are hundreds of years old. And the stories they tell aren't always as accessible as just looking at dollops of color on a more modern canvas might be. I spoke with one dealer, Patrick Williams, who told me tastes are moving away from Christian art to more secular paintings.
We're trying to buy more blood, sex, and mythology. You know, the deposition from the cross, St. Mark, that's not what really people are looking for anymore. People are looking for interesting narratives. You know, that's sort of much more of a contemporary mindset. And honestly, those pictures hang a lot better with a collection that has different, you know, areas of interest.
And apart from this move away from religious art, were there any other trends on display there?
I think it's also important to look at what museums are buying. And as I mentioned, this is the place where museum directors and museum trustees are going to shop. And the biggest trend by far was the rise in value and prominence of female artists. There were not very many old masters who were also female for reasons of social structure and the limitations imposed on women. But when those do come up for auction or sale, they are bought up extremely extremely quickly. One dealer told me he feels like a contemporary art dealer whenever he has a painting that's been done by a woman. Museums are trying to rebalance their collection. They feel that their trustees and the public are interested in broadening the canon beyond the art, the male artists that people have heard about. But the reality is that there's not very much to buy. This is a bigger issue more broadly with European old masters. The supply is shrinking. And I spoke to another dealer who mentioned that as more is disappearing into museums and being gifted by donors to museums, the trade is just becoming a lot more difficult. It's a finite supply that's increasingly privately owned. Some hope that as the supply shrinks, values will rise. But in order for that to continue to be the case, people have to want to buy these paintings. I don't see any imminent change being likely in the market for old masters.
Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ori.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Guys, it's crunch time. Our discount on annual and two-year subscriptions to Economist Podcast Plus ends this Sunday. I know some of you have been procrastinating, putting a note on your to-do list to do it every day, and you just keep forgetting to click the link. Yeah, I know. That's why I'm here, to remind you again. Where else are you getting shows about China, business, science and tech, the war in Ukraine, management, and more, for less than $2.50 a month? So come on, join the club. All the details you need are in the show notes, or you can simply search for Economist Podcast Plus on your favorite search engine. But that's enough from me. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.